Okay. Yep, I'm on. Very good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another level 666 talk. That's what people have tweeted about before, so I will try to keep the standard high today. I'm going to talk about Link Take-Two, realizing the Link to Everything dream. My name is Bart. I'm working in the cloud programmability team at Microsoft, where I make a living building Link providers nowadays and all sorts that are technologies that are related to Link, such as reactive extensions. So what I want to do today is give you some thoughts about where we are with Link and some of the crazy things we can take it to the next level with. Now, by its very design, this talk contains a lot of loose thoughts, so don't expect anything consistent out of this. It's a lot of random topics, and they all sort of have isolated units to them. Like, so if you are interested in query providers, there will be something for you. If you're interested in, say, for example, solving Sudokus using Link expressions, you will see that at the end of the talk as well. So, pick your choice. Good. So a little historical perspective to get started. This is the slide from PDC a number of years ago where we introduced the Link project, Language Integrated Query. And if we take a look at what was then future technologies, which is over 5 years ago, actually I should update the slide really, we see that when we compare this to what we have today, there hasn't been that much innovation in the core of Link. We have expression trees, we have query operators. It's not really the case that for things like Link to Objects, we need many more operators to be very expressive. We already are very expressive using what we have. So standard query operators was not really a place where we invested a lot lately. In .NET 4, for example, we had one more operator added, which was the zip operator. So that sort of shows the maturity of the query operator set quite well, even though it's the case that we can look at different domains that we can make Link capable. Like, for example, I will show reactive extensions where we query over streams of data, event streams of data, where the notion of time becomes important. So like, for example, timing out an event stream makes a lot of sense. Timing out a for each loop sometimes makes sense too. So we have some interesting synergy there between new operators and reactive extensions and what we could take to Link itself. Another thing is that since I'm in the cloud programmability team, I should have the word cloud at least once in my slide. So here it is. So I've actually met my commitment for this talk. But really, when we look at cloud, those little cylinders in the middle here, which are relational database engines, do not always make sense. Also, XML doesn't always make sense. Today, people have JSON, document stores, those kind of things. Can we use Link for that as well? Absolutely. So the question is, how should we do that? So a number of questions here. I hope to answer a few of them at least today. Now, before I get actually into the practical stuff, I'd like to start with a little bit of brain explosion stuff by actually demystifying that language-integrated query really should be called language-integrated monads. Monads are not a disease, they're a functional programming concept. So what's this thing all about? It's basically illustrating that Link is very powerful. So let's actually break it down a little bit in this slide. So when you search for monads on Wikipedia, you find that the monad contains two operations, which are called bind and return, as well as a type constructor M. Now that sounds like Chinese, and that's not to be politically incorrect. I should really use an ancient language here. It's something that looks a little strange at the face of it. So I will explain in just a moment how those things are already in Link today. But so I'm just trying to show you that Link really is a monad. Secondly, why do we want to do monads? Well, here it says that a monad is ideal to build a pipeline. Well, a pipeline is really what Link is, right? You have data, you pipe it to where, you pipe it to select, you pipe it to order by. You basically have a pipeline of data. So this Wikipedia article is really talking about something that Link really implements. So no coincidence there. And finally, how do we actually work with those monads? Well, we actually build a pipeline by composing monadic functions together. Now, of course, I haven't really completely explained what a monad is yet, the blue part, so let's drill into that a little bit. And then I will show you that you can do something totally wacky using Link because it's actually a monad. So let's explain this. So here are the three ingredients to a secret monad sauce. First of all, you need a type constructor. Well, I can tell you that we already have two type constructors, or the closest approximation there to in the CLR, IEnumerable of T and IQueryable of T. So just substitute M in the rest of this this little picture here with IEnumerable or IQueryable of your choice. So now let's take a look at the two ingredients you need to be considered a monad. That's a very mathematical kind of thing. You know, if you have those two things, well, you can apply this whole book of theory to it. So what are the two other things we need? We need a way to return. What's the idea of returning? Return says, give me something of type A, and I can lift it into the monad. That's like to sort of enter the ship. How do you go from a value of type A onto, say, for example, an IEnumerable of A? The answer is you simply create an array with a single element around it. So then you're enumerable, and once you're an enumerable, you can do all that richness of link. That's the idea of return. How do you get into the world of link? The second thing you need is an operator called bind. Now, if you can sort of translate or transcode this arrow syntax, which is functional syntax, and say that you substitute A for T and B for R and M for IEnumerable, then you will find that's exactly the signature of select many, which is one of the query operators in link. We do have those two things. We have the capability of creating an array. We have a select many thing. Hence, it's a monad. Hence, you can read hundreds of books on monadic computation with category theory, and everything can be done using link. So that's beautiful. So let's now see why that's relevant. Now, by the way, actually, if you have return and select many, you can implement about 90% of the query operators in link just using those two things. And actually, I've done that exercise on CodePlex. You can find a project called LinkSQO, where I implement where and select and all those guys in terms of select many. So that's a nice thing to do. You know, at night, if you don't have anything else to do like me, then you do that kind of stuff. So let's build something called the maybe monad. So this is to show that link is very powerful. This is an often heard question or feature request by the C# team. People say, well, you have null coalescing, the double question mark operator, but wouldn't it be nice that you have something like a null propagating dot? Meaning that in this piece of code, if name is null, please don't throw me a null reference exception. Instead, simply don't call toUpper and propagate the null value true. In case name is not null, then you call toUpper. So question dot would mean null check, and if not null, do the rest of the thing to the right. So people ask for that, and you know, we've resisted to actually implement that. There are some good reasons for that. Say that you have a long chain of those question dot, question dot, question dot. And you would also need to have question square bracket for null propagating indexers and question open bracket for null propagating delegate invocations. Like, it gets quite a slew of things. But say that you're debugging something that has 15 question dot operators in it. Where did it become null so that the whole expression became null? Like, it gets kind of a debugging nightmare, in my opinion. So I'm not totally opposed to not having the feature, but say that we would implement it, how would we do so? Well, you knock on the door of the C# compiler team, and they will say, oh, that would be kind of trivial. We would first have a branch false instruction, and we would check for null, and we would do this and that and blah. So they would say, we're going to implement it using IL. I would say, no. Let's implement question dot as a syntactic translation to a link query, because we already have that in C#. So we could implement this C# 14.0 function or feature in terms of a C# 3.0 feature. That's beauty itself, in my opinion. So that's my suggestion. Let's implement this feature using this. The question dot operator turns into from some generated name in name, from s in the generated name dot to upper select s. Oh my goodness, what does that mean? So let's take a look. Here's the secret. The secret is that the compiler actually turns the syntax, the from select syntax, into a call to select many. So at this point, we're actually in a state where we call a library function as opposed to rely on some code that was generated. Now, how can we do the null propagation here? Well, because it's a method, I can implement a null check in the method, say that it's an extension method, and do all the logic for null propagation in there. So that actually shows that link can compute much more aspects to your computation than just doing iteration with for each loops and those kind of things. So let's just give a demo of that to show that I'm not lying, that this is possible. So here we are. assume that this thing, you know, the result equals name.toUpper with that little question mark, which would be the null propagating dot, is translated into this query. Will this thing execute? Well, the answer is yes. Let's do Ctrl+F5 on that, and it will return name2upper, which is Bart in uppercase, right? There we go. If I would actually put in here a null string, which would be default of string, it would return null, which is, you know, the thing I'm printing over here. Now, how does it work? Let's actually do this one. If I execute this code using F10, just follow carefully. F11 for step into. Oh my goodness, I'm in a select many call. That select many method doesn't need to be on IEnumerable of T. It doesn't need to be on IQueryable of T. The compiler couldn't care less where it finds the damn method. In this case, I've implemented an extension method on T, where T is a class, because then it's nullable. And so now I'm in this extension method that lives on every reference type, and here I will actually enforce the null propagation. So value in this case is null, hence we will say, let's return the default of the return type, which will be null itself. So we're propagating null. And so we come out of this method, we come back to the link syntax, and here we are with a result that's null. Now, if I would actually, in here, say Bart, let's actually see what happens now. F11, we go in the select many call. The value is Bart, which is the first parameter of the extension method, F10. Now we're going to call the result selector and the selector of the value. Where does that live? Let's do F11. Oh, that's that piece of code that now gets executed. So select many is calling back to that part of the link expression to now do the two upper one, because it has seen that the under bar can never be null. So we've protected against null references. So we do that return thing. We do also an F11 to this little part of the link expression. That's the way select many works. That thing just returns that value. We come out of it, and we have Bart in uppercase. So you see, now I can use just link syntax to do null propagation. I wouldn't encourage you to write all your null checking code using link expressions from now on, but it shows that there is something very powerful behind the scenes. So that for the academic intro. Now let's get into a separate topic. So forget about this, erase your memory. You can still find it on video. And let's go to the next stage. Second topic. So after every topic, you can reset your brain to zero, and then we build up again. So that's the way this talk is designed. So here's a practical question for you. IQueryable of T is this beautiful thing that can do link to SQL, link to entities, link to Active Directory, link to SharePoint, link to Amazon, all of that stuff. Do we really need it? Okay. So here, say that you have source of product, where source is something on some data source, right? It could be, say, an Amazon table or something. Now I have source of product, it implements IQueryable, hence I can write this query at the bottom of the slide. From where group by. Beautiful. Compiler says, great, this works, because there are extension methods for where and group by. However, if I execute this thing, it says, oh my goodness, this is not supported. It says the group by operator is not supported. Why was I able to write that thing in the first place? Couldn't you check that at compile time that the group by operator is not available? The answer is, we definitely could. So let's take a look at how we could actually make a better link provider without using IQueryable. So here I have from where group by. That actually translates, and you can find it in the C# language spec, and that's, you know, where link sort of meets the other primitives of the language. This gets erased into a call to where and group by. Now, how can we make this thing not compile the group by? Well, the language spec doesn't say anything that it needs to find where and group by as extension methods on interfaces. It just says, I'm going to look for a where method using overload resolution rules. So those things could be instance methods as well. So say that source of T, source of product, doesn't implement IQueryable of T, but simply has a where method available with the right signature, then we would actually be able to call the where method. Hence, we should be able to write the where keyword in the link expression. So say that source of T has a where method that returns a filtered of T, and say that filtered of T has a select method that returns projected of T, but it doesn't have a group by method, then we'll get this effect in the query expression. The compiler will say, I can't find group by. So now you have compile time checking for your query operators that are supported by the data source. Now, it just so happens that we did link to SQL first, and link to SQL is something where you have this huge compositionality of the query operators. And can do 15 ways with an order by, and then a select, and then a join, and then this and that, and it all works. So there, iQueryable is great, because you can continue dotting in query operators. But if you have some silly data store that only supports a where, like, for example, link to Twitter, then in that case, well, you don't want to use iQueryable. You just want to have a single instance method or something. And so what I really do here at the bottom of the slide is I'm building a state machine of types. If you filter something, you get a filtered of T. And after filtering, you can still do a select, because there is a select method on filtered of T. So you basically guide the user to the capabilities of the query language. So let's take it one step further. Link to Twitter. There are some link to Twitter implementations out there, and I say, oh my goodness. So this is how I think it should be. So if you do from tweet in Twitter, where tweet dot, assume that the IntelliSense gives you a byte from and location. So the user says, you know, I want to search for something that's tweeted by Bart. Now say that the user types where tweet dot, wouldn't it be nice that it would just show about and location, because I've already filtered on from. I can't filter on that thing twice, right? Well, actually, you can totally do that using C# Trio. All the materials are in the room to get this experience. You don't need to change the IntelliSense engine. You don't need to do anything in the IDE to make this work. I will show you how. So this is a little secret for today. So where tweet.about equals link, and then I could do where tweet dot, and I would only see location. And then when I try to do another where, it would start complaining because I've used all my shots at filtering. And ultimately, I do select tweet. What's the recipe? Method overloading, state machine of types, operator overloading. So let's take a look at how this works. The idea is that the type of Twitter is Twitter. And Twitter has an instance method called where. It doesn't implement iQueryable of tweet. It simply has an instance method called where. Now look at the signature of where. Nobody said that the where method needs to be a function that takes in T and returns a Boolean. The language specification has never said that it needs to return a Boolean. So let's return something else, because we can. So the input to the where method is something of type tweet about from lock. What's that? Well, that's this thing. Tweet about from lock has three public properties. Because of PowerPoint incompatibility with properties, I use fields. But so assume those are properties, from about and location. So that means that when the user does where tweet dot, he sees from, about, and location. Now also look at the return type of those guys. From actually returns a from string, even not a CLR string. Because if it would be a CLR string, the user could do something like where tweet dot from dot normalize dot to upper dot equals dot this dot that. That's not supported by Twitter. It only supports raw equality. So I create my own custom type to represent a string, as Twitter knows strings, not the CLR strings. So I have a from string. The from string has an operator overload to compare a from string to a regular CLR string, and that returns a filter from, operator overloading to its best. That means that if the user writes where tweet.from equals Bart, we take that operator overload, which in reality needs to be statically, that actually needs to be declared as static. I just omitted that over here. And then we basically choose that overload to where, because it returns a filter from. Now, because we actually chose that overload, so that's the result of doing that equality check, we get back a something that's typed to be Twitter by from. Now, what's a Twitter by from? That's, again, a Twitter, you know, data source that can be filtered, but it already knows in its type name that it actually has been filtered already on the from keyword. So in other words, this whole expression, this first two lines of the link query have typed Twitter by from, and now the Twitter by from has a where method again that has now a tweet about lock as its input. It doesn't have a tweet about from lock anymore. It doesn't show the from part. So now I have a new type, and exactly when you do now where tweet dot, you will only see about and location. So the little secret here is that the type of tweet can be different in every part of the query expression. The C# spec never said that it needs to be the same type all the way through. So that's just how it works. So let's actually give a demo of this little technique on how to build a statically compiled or compilable query expression that has verification and all of that stuff built in at compile time. So here I have linked to IMDb. It's even simpler than Twitter. You can only filter on title and year. So, you know, very simple. So let me show you the experience of writing a query in this thing. Where movie.title equals, well, actually I should not be that quick. You have title here and you have year here, right? So let's do where title equals Titanic, where movie.year, oh, notice that there is no title anymore. The title has been filtered away from the IntelliSense. That's just because the movie now has a different type. The first time, it's a movie that has a year and a title. Now it's a movie that only has a year. If I would first filter on year over here, 1997, where movie dot, oh, now I can only select the title. So I can do it in any order, it just works. And I can now try to do where movie dot, and you see I don't get IntelliSense anymore because I can't do a third where. So I'm basically being guided through a state machine of types that says, I've already done a filter on year. I've already done a filter on year and title. Hence, there is no where method anymore to filter any further. Yep, question.
What if you want to do a range of years?
Uh-huh.
Then there's no more years.
If you want to do a range of years?
Like bigger than 1990 and smaller than 2000.
Okay, it turns out that IMDb doesn't support larger than or lower than. But you could totally do that. You could do that by having, you know, some other type that's returned from the operator overload of less than and larger than, that basically keeps track of whether you've already done a larger than or a lower than thing. And then you could only do one of both. If you try to do more than them, well, you could also do some mathematics, of course. Like, if it's larger than 18 and larger than 21, it ought to be larger than, you know, the minimum of the two or something. That gets totally crazy. But, you know, that's a good challenge on the plane back. So, but so, we can write this query. Whoops. We can write this query. Let's see how it works. If I go to IMDb, you see that IMDb has a where method that has a movie query title year. So that's a movie that has a title and a year property on it. And it returns a year filter. If I choose this one, I return a filtered by year. And a filtered by year object has a where method that has a movie query title. It doesn't have the year anymore. And that thing returns a title filter. So now I have a filtered by both the year and the title. And a filtered by year and title doesn't have a where method anymore, as you can see. That's why actually the compiler says that I can't do a third where anymore. If I try to do here where true, it would say, oops, unfiltered by year and title, I could not find a where method. So you have compile time checking now of this whole thing. Now, one more thing about this is, actually, I do a for each over this thing, and I do have system.link sitting there. If I for each over something, it ought to be an IEnumerable, right? And if it's an IEnumerable and I have system.link, don't I get all the link query operators for free? Like if I do res dot, shouldn't I see where and select and group by and order by and distinct and all of that stuff? Huh, how does that work? Well, the answer is you don't need to be an IEnumerable to be for eachable. The C-sharp language has never said you need to implement IEnumerable of T to have for each support. It simply says, if you have a getEnumerator method, and if you have on the result of the getEnumerator move next and a current property, for each just works. So, yeah. Good point. Yeah, so if you do it this way, don't you get a lot of code? It depends on the expressiveness of the underlying API. So like in this case, the query language is so poor that it doesn't make any problem. As soon as you get like a query language that has a lot of possibilities, you can do a number of tricks. You could say, I can only write query expressions in a certain order. Say that you do where and order by and select. You could say, you first need to do order by, then where, and then select or something. If it really becomes a very extensive language like SQL, this is not a technique to use. So it's for the silly, stupid data sources that only support where and select, for example. This is a great technique. For anything more than that, you might want to use iQueryable, or you can also do something in the middle, right? You could create your own iSlim queryable of T that only has extension methods for where and select, but then the user can do it in any order still. So you can sort of dial, you know, between the two extremes, if you will. So this shows one extreme pretty clearly. So as I said, movie enumerable, the result of my entire query, is not IEnumerable. Hence, if it's not an enumerable of T, I don't get all the extension methods from link to objects, which is a good thing. I might actually also implement as enumerable on this thing so that you actually can go to link to objects explicitly. And that's what I do here. So if you still want to go back to the link operators, I want you to be explicit that that thing is going to happen on the client as opposed to on the server. So if the user says, well, I know that link to IMDb only supports two wares, but still I want to sort this stuff, you can do dot as enumerable on that, and then you get the whole list of enumerable of T-based extension methods. But you have to be explicit about where things happen remotely, where things happen locally. So that's the technique in a nutshell, and in fact, this link provider should work. So Titanic got a 7.4 before the ship actually sunk. Good. Maybe a bad joke, but whatever. Good, so let's go back to the slides, and again, empty your brain, flush the buffers. Next topic. So here's the next topic. Let's talk a little bit about using link to something that's not enumerable. So you might already have seen it if you were in one of my previous talks. I've showed reactive extensions for .NET, RX, which is a way to do queries over event streams. So for example, if you want to do a query over, say, for example, Twitter data, or you want to do a query over RSS feeds or stock quotes, you could actually use link to events, which is also known as RX. So that's what it is. You can download it for a variety of platforms on MSDN, on NuGet. It's a library to compose those event-based programs together. Composition means that you don't have to write a lot of code to do something rather complex in this particular interpretation. And the idea is that we do it using observable sequences. Because it's a sequence, it lends itself very nicely to link. I've already shown that for link, you don't need to be a sequence even, right? Like for the maybe monad, the null propagation thing, we didn't use a sequence at all. We were doing link over system.object. But so for sequences, link is the ideal fit in a lot of cases. So very briefly, for those of you who've already seen it, you can go into hibernation mode for 5 minutes. So the idea of RX is to have, as opposed to pool-based data access, we have push-based data access. What does that mean? Well, if you use an enumerable of T interface, say for example on link to SQL, you're basically pulling data out of the data source by doing a move next call. You're saying, I have a sequence, move to the next element, and you pull the data into your application. Move to the next element, you pull it into your application. So you're in control of the pace at which things are happening. In the reactive world, it's the opposite thing. With an iObservable of T, you're basically telling it, I'm interested in getting notifications whenever data becomes available, and then that data source pushes the data into your application. That's event-driven systems, really. The slide is kind of reactive as well. I still have some timing in there. But so that's the big idea. Data gets pushed into the application as opposed to you initiating the retrieval of the data for every element. So here are the interfaces. They actually live in the .NET 4 BCL. It's called iObservable and iObserver. The basic idea is this. You walk up to an iObservable by giving it an observer and say, this is the way to call me back whenever you get data. That's like if you subscribe to a newspaper, you do exactly the same, right? You're sending a letter with the address of your mailbox. That's the iObserver of the newspaper. And then what you get back is an iDisposable, which is a little ticket, a little mail or a letter that you can send back to the publisher to say, I do not longer want to receive editions of this newspaper. So that's the subscribe contract. And then the iObservable or the iObserver of T is like your letterbox. Whenever there is a new message coming in, you get on next of a letter in the letterbox. If something went wrong, you get an error, an exception in your letterbox. And if something, or if the newspaper no longer exists, you get an on completion message. Basically, the newspaper telling you that, you know, it's out of print and it will never ship again. So that's the idea of iObservable of T. So it's a different way of getting to data. It's not pool-based, it's push-based, it's event-driven systems. So once we introduce that, we realize that the landscape of data acquisition consists of three dimensions. So let's actually take a look at that. One dimension we'll talk about later. But there are only two ways to get to data. How do you get to data in your application? Either you ask for it or it gets thrown at you. Those are the two options. So it's kind of binary black and white. So we have pool-based data access, which we call interactive programming using IEnumerable of T. We have push-based using IObservable of T. You can convert between the two. I'm not going to talk about conversions between the two. It's actually available. So that's two ways to get to data. A second axis is about where things execute in the system. That's something we introduced for reactive extensions, because for asynchronous event-based programming, often you need to introduce concurrency. Say that you say, I want to create a timer that fires every second the value at the consumer. But the consumer should not be blocked while that timer is going. So it really needs to generate those values on some concurrency context. It might need to introduce a thread, use the Windows Forms timer, might actually run a timer in the cloud or something. So you need to say where things need to execute. That's the notion of a scheduler. I'm not going to talk about this in this section, but we have many implementations of iScheduler. So those are already two dimensions, what you want to query, and actually basically how you get to the data, and where things execute. Now, the third axis is how you represent your queries. And so that's the one I want to talk about right now. Either when you write a query, it turns into MSIL code that executes on the client. That's what happens with link to objects. If in a link to objects query, you write something like from x in x's, where x is larger than 5, that x larger than 5 thing gets executed by the CLR on the client, right? However, you can also do link using expression trees. For example, iQueryable of T, or you know some approach that's hybrid. You would actually have, for example, link to SQL using that technique so that it can take a look at the query expression in its entirety and say, oh, the user is trying to do a filter on X, and I know how to do that in T-SQL. So they translate it into T-SQL. Now, I invite you to take this picture to any mathematician and say, what do you think about the picture? They stare at you and laugh at you, saying that this picture is asymmetric, it can't be right. So something is missing in the top right corner, and that's the one I want to introduce right now. You can also have expression-based queries, meaning queries that can be remoded into a different engine than the CLR for event-based systems. So that's what we call iQObservable, which is an interface that's much like iObservable in a sense that it's push-based, but it's based on expression trees. So for example, you can do link to WMI events. Because if you do link to WMI events, you're basically building a query that's sent to the WMI engine to execute the filtering of the events closer to the data source, as opposed to in your CLR application itself. So you want to travel the query as close as possible to where the data exists. So that's actually the interface we have there. So let's talk about it a little bit. So those are two interfaces that exist in the reactive extensions. Now, how many of you have implemented iQueryable of T? Nobody? Oh, one person, two persons? Three, four, five, a couple. Okay. So, in fact, this slide assumes that you sort of know how iQueryable of T looks like and how iQuery provider looks like. For those of you who have implemented iQueryable of T, you will notice a couple of differences. And let's actually point out a couple of them. On iQuery provider, at the bottom of the slide, you know, the equivalent for link to objects, link to SQL, you actually have an execute method. An execute method on a query provider is used for scalar value returning operators. So for example, if you write a query provider like link to SQL, and the user is writing something like from P in products where product price is larger than da-da-da, and then he does select P and then dot sum on that whole thing, that returns a scalar value, which is a decimal that sums together the prices of all the products, right? So in that case, there is a handshake happening in the link infrastructure. And again, I have some timing here. That's a bad thing. There's a handshake happening to the query provider to say, hey, do you know how to execute this particular expression on the spot? So, you know, when you do a sum, it executes right there. Now, what's the flaw with that for event-based programming? When you do event-based programming, you don't want the execution of the query to start immediately. Say that you do dot average on NASDAQ. Well, dot average on NASDAQ might return at the end of the day, right? Do you want to be blocked till the end of the day? No, you want to return an iObservable that you can subscribe to, then forget about it, and somewhere in the future it comes back to you saying, oh, and by the way, the average for the day was 35.59 or something. And in the meantime, you can even unsubscribe. You can cancel the computation. So we don't have an execute method in reactive extensions because it would be blocking. And blocking is not the way of life in asynchronous event-based programming. So that's why we don't have an execute method. Second thing that's different here is the thing I actually pointed out here. It's in a different order than I wanted to talk about it. The query provider for Rx actually also has query operations on top of it. Let me actually walk you through the dialogue of doing a concat operation in link to SQL. So say, for example, you have two tables with the same schema on two different servers, maybe, and say that the query provider supports querying multiple servers. It doesn't, but say it does. You have the first source, say it's called products, and you have the second source called catalog. You have those two sources, right? And now you're saying .concat between the two. Products, .concat, catalog. Okay? The way that executes in classic link is as follows. Hey, dear data source on the left, products, do you know how to concatenate yourself to the catalog of that other company? So basically there is a handshake happening to the left-hand side of the concat. That's kind of weird that one of the two is sort of biased or one of the two has a bigger role than the other one. In event-based systems, that often is like a security kind of issue even. Say that you do, link to eBay and link to some other, bidding service on the internet. And now you want to get, bits on products and merge them together. Do you want to do eBay.merge with some different source if the way it's implemented behind the scenes is that the merge operator asks very friendly, dear eBay, do you know how to merge your results together with the results from this competitive bidding service? They might say, yes, I know how to do that. And the way I will do it is by actually forgetting about competitive bids at all, just don't forward them. That would be a pretty nice attack based on the way that things actually handshake. So we say you can have those neutral query providers that you can say, query provider, you're a broker service, and you will merge together open parentheses, eBay, comma, other service, comma, other service. And that party is neutral. That one knows how to merge things together. There's no party that's actually beneficial in there. So that's the idea why we have a different way of approaching that. So let's take a look at link to WMI events and show how that actually works. So here we are. So what I'm doing here is I'm going to filter process start traces, which is basically a process ID and a process name with some attribute on top of it, which is like a mapping for, in link to SQL, you would actually map a class onto a table name, right? Here I'm mapping a class onto a WMI object type. So I'm basically mapping process start trace on this Win32 process start trace thing. You could also envision mapping attributes on columns, just like you actually have in link to SQL. Or link to entities or whatever. So we have the process start trace here. Now I can create the equivalent to a table of T in link to SQL. So now I'm going to create an event provider of the process start trace. That's basically a representation of WMI sending me process start traces. I'm going to specify a logger so that I see the code generated. Now I can write a query. I can say where the process name equals notepad, select out the process name and the process ID. Just a regular link query. Ultimately, I'm going to say, but hey, the things that WMI can do are not as expressive as link to events from reactive extensions. I might want to do a little bit more that the query provider doesn't support. Like WMI doesn't know how to put a timestamp on every message. You can't ask the provider there how to do that. You can try that query. You would get a not supported exception. So you can basically do exactly the same as with link to SQL. If link to SQL lets you down, you can do .asEnumerable and then start filtering and doing all sorts of things locally because the service couldn't do it. So you can basically return to local execution mode. And so I'm saying locally, I'm going to timestamp all the messages coming from WMI using the local clock of the system. So this thing actually takes an iObservable of T to an iObservable of timestamped of T. And timestamped contains a timestamp, which is of date time offset, as well as the T value that was originally passed in. And now on this thing, I can do result of subscribe. On a link to events query, you don't do for each, because for each would be blocking. Instead, you subscribe a callback mechanism. So you say result.subscribe, whenever a new process is born, do console write line of T, T for trace. When this whole sequence completes, I'm going to print complete. In fact, it's never going to complete, so let's just get rid of that. But so that's basically a callback that's specified here. And then while that thing is registered, in the main block of my code, on a different thread really, because this is multi-threaded kind of infrastructure, WMI is raising events somewhere else, I'm going just to start some notepad.exe instances, 5 instances, 2 seconds apart. So I'm just having my application do that. I could also do start run notepad, right? So if I execute this thing using F5, you actually see that that's the query generated, select process name, comma process ID from win32 underscore process start trace, where the process name equals notepad.exe. We are spawning notepad processes, and the notepad processes come back to the event handler saying that they have been born at a certain point in time. So now I wrote a query that was actually translated into something that WMI knows how to deal with. It knows how to deal with the process names close to the machine. You could even do that in a distributed setting, right? You could say, whenever any machine in my computer farm starts notepad.exe. It's much better that the process start trace is actually filtered on the remote machine as opposed to filtering everything locally, right? Because then you would get all the process names for all the machines in your farm. Had a question? Oh, yes, it's running indefinitely now. If I start a new notepad manually, it should come out over there. There it is. So that event handler is sitting there. In the meantime, I could pump some UI thread or whatever, right? But so it's running in the background now. For every notepad, this will come out. I'll actually prove that to you. I set a breakpoint here, create a new notepad instance. You have to say on WMI, there is something called, some time windowing kind of thing. You can basically tell WMI how chatty it needs to be. And by default, it sort of allows a buffer of 1 second so that it doesn't need to hog the system to send events out immediately. Yep.
One question about the syntax.
Yep.
It says logger, colon, and then comes all.
Yes.
I'm not familiar with that.
That's the syntax for logger colon is actually the named parameter syntax of C# 4.0. So I'm basically passing in a parameter that takes in a text writer. And it's called logger, and it happens to be the third parameter, which is optional, so I actually specify it by name. Which I do quite often right now, because if you have a method that takes in 15 null parameters, it's kind of handy to know what the null parameter means, so I just put the name of the parameter in front of it. The reason it's a colon is because the equal syntax would actually be ambiguous with C# 1.0 specification. Because if it would be equals, this code would already have compiled in C# 1.0. It would mean assign console out to a local variable called logger, and then use the result of that for the zeroth parameter of the thing. So to be backwards compatible, we needed to choose a different symbol, so we chose colon. Okay. So a little historical anecdote here. But so we're hitting the process start trace for notepad.exe. If you look at the call stack, you see that the call stack actually goes all the way down to external code, and the external code will be system.management.dll, where there is some event sync sitting and waiting for events to come out of the WMI infrastructure. So you see that that thing is now causing an event to bubble into my system and do console write line on top of that. So that's how link to events actually works. Good. So next, how am I doing on time? I might actually go a little quicker over this one. How many people know about the async CTP? Okay. How many of those people were not in my talk? That's great. You know, some people know that already. Still quite a few people who haven't heard of it, so a very brief introduction to it. Essence of the feature. Instead of writing continuations, which means, say that you have a task of something that returns a value, and you want to say what the system should do when that task completes its execution, in the past you would have to do, in this case, name.continue with lambda expression of all the code that needs to execute after the task completes. And so your code starts to look ugly because you need to do name.continue with indent next lambda expression. And then if you do an asynchronous call again, you need to do continue with again. And so the thing starts to look quite ugly. And it doesn't compose anymore with regular control flow. You can't do easily an if because, well, you have all those lambda expressions sitting there. It becomes very ugly. So in C# vnext and VB vnext, we have this feature called await. So you can await an asynchronous operation. And basically what that does is it does not block your thread till that thing is complete. The thread can actually be yielded and somebody else can work on the thread. And when the thing actually becomes available, when the data becomes available, the rest of the code starts executing. So it's like pausable methods. The method can be paused upon an await, and the rest of the method will execute whenever the data becomes available. Say you're doing a web service call, you know the rest of the method will be executed when the web service call returns. But you're not blocking, for example, the UI thread by doing an await. Basically, the method will return early, prematurely. So it looks like a little bit of magic. We have great content on it, and it's actually not that hard. You just need to make a little click in your mind and see a couple of samples. But so the idea is you can await a task, and the result of awaiting a task of T is something of type T. That's the value coming out of the task. And then your code can continue executing, for example, to return the length of the task or of the content of the task. So you can await something, which is nice. However, don't care about the return type in this case. The way this feature is implemented is based on something called the awaiter pattern. So once more, just like we've seen with link, just like we've seen with the for each keyword, the C# compiler doesn't care a bit about where it does find the methods that are part of the awaiter pattern. In fact, await name is actually turned into something like name.getAwaiter, store it in a local variable. On the awaiter, do something like uncompleted and all those kind of things. So it's just a contract of everything that implements those methods can actually be awaited. So awaiting a task of T returns the value that sits in the task. What would it mean to await an observable, an event stream, which can have multiple values, right? If you await the stock exchange, what would that mean? Well, we actually chose to implement in Rx the awaiter pattern, so we can await an iObservable sequence. And we chose the last result, the last value of the sequence, to be the thing that comes out of it. So you can actually await a sequence, and you get the last value. Now, in a lot of cases, sequences are infinite, so that doesn't ever return. But you can always, you know, do something like, you know, await the observable dot take 5. Which means you would get the fifth element, right? Because you basically cut it off after 5 elements. So with composition, you can actually do a lot of things, and the last result makes a lot of sense as the choice there. So that just shows that you know, those things like await are not incompatible with event sequences and things that are linkable. So that's a nice thing to know. I will skip this one. We've also thought about doing something called async enumerators and async enumerables. Let's forget about that one. We actually shipped that as part of Rx as a prototype of some random thought we have out there. So let's get to something even more exciting. I will skip the Rx support for await, actually. Let's talk about schedulers. So what's a scheduler? That's something we introduced in Rx. And we think it might be much more useful than just for Rx. In fact, it might be useful for everything that has to do something with link, and especially in the cloud. So let's talk a little bit about this one. And how many have used Rx? A few, okay. How many of those know iScheduler? Okay. How many of those don't recognize this interface because we've changed it? Okay. So yeah, the interface has changed a bit, but the basic idea is this. A scheduler is something you can send work to. That could be a separate thread, it could be a thread pool, it could be a task pool, it could be a farm of machines on the other side of the world. All those things could be iSchedulers, right? So the way you communicate with a scheduler is, well, you can ask the scheduler what time it is. And that's actually the reason we have schedulers at the bottom of the slide, but let's not go into that just yet. So you can ask a scheduler what time it is, because that's important for distributed scenarios, like your time will not be the same as the time on a scheduler. I should really get rid of those timings. Secondly, you can schedule in three different ways. You can say, dear scheduler, execute something right now. That's the first overload. You can say, dear scheduler, execute something in a relative time from now, say in 5 seconds. And you can say, dear scheduler, schedule something on Christmas next year, which is done using a daytime offset, which is absolute time. So those are the ways you can actually talk to the scheduler. We have a state parameter as well that's used to serialize state from the client to the server. So that's something in addition. The rest of the signature I won't really talk about, other than saying that iDisposable is used to basically cancel the work if it hasn't been started yet. So you can schedule something for Christmas next year, but then you say, well, there are no turkeys anymore anyway, so we shouldn't order turkeys, so we'll dispose the scheduling of the turkey delivery on December next year. So that's why we have iDisposable coming out of those guys. The reason we have that is because, well, for enumerables, you don't need concurrency. There is just somebody doing for each, right? For each, go to the next element. For each, go to the next element. You're basically in pace with the data source. However, for an observable sequence, you want to be asynchronous. It's event-based. So typically, there's some worker that generates items behind the scenes, and then it pumps them out to you. So you need concurrency. There need to be two parties that can evolve separately. So that could be like, you know, for example, a timer thread that's pumping messages, and you're just, you know, being called whenever something happens. So that's why we actually need schedulers. Now, the reason we have schedulers, that actually came about kind of accidentally, which is a funny thing. So this is an Rx query that does something like taking input from a text box, and then using the input from the text box. We actually had a great talk by Mike Talty on Rx this week. So if you didn't go to the talk, you can actually find much more info on reactive extensions by watching that talk later and understand what the syntax is doing here. But so I'm basically joining input from a text box with asynchronous web service calls. Whenever the user types something, I'm going to talk to web service, say, what are the results for that given input? So that's the dialogue that's sort of established here as a link query, which is pretty nifty in, you know, very dense piece of code. So what's really happening here is when I subscribe to this piece of code, what happens is that we will get called whenever words come back from the web service, because the user typed some word, the web service did a lookup, called us back. Well, that callback is actually happening on a completion thread for an asynchronous operation, which is not the UI thread typically. So what we end up with is, oh, I should really get rid of those timings. What really happens now, and I'm already revealing the secrets here, I will disable them next time I go out of PowerPoint. When you execute this code, what happens is that we try to update the UI thread from that callback, which happens to run on the thread pool. And that's not something you should do with the dear UI thread. It starts complaining quite vocally. So how did we decide to fix that? We went back and forth a lot of times. Originally, we said, oh, we should always use a synchronization context, or we should always go to the UI thread, or we should always do this. Well, we said, can't we parameterize that? And that's goodness for a lot of reasons. So we said, what if we introduce the notion of a scheduler, which is where messages are being sent out, and now you can do something like results, but oh, by the way, the results come out on the wrong thread, let's observe them on a different thread. So you do observe on, you pass in a scheduler, and that's the one that will pump out the values. So you basically say where things start executing, where your event handler is invoked. So now the code listItems.clear and addRange executes on the Windows Forms loop in this case, because I pass in a control scheduler. So that's how schedulers actually came about, was more to solve this problem, but then we realized they can do much more for us. So here's a concrete question that is just a random thought. I haven't implemented this, but you know, it's definitely a possibility. If you look at this thing, if you look at, for example, link to SQL, and they generate this dear data context for you, what's the data context really provide you? Well, it's the entry point to the OR mapping, right? It's the entry point to your schema. You can dot into products, dot into categories, dot into suppliers. Beautiful. However, it does a second thing, which in my opinion is totally orthogonal. A Nordman data context also has a baked-in notion of where things execute.
because it basically has a data connection string associated with it. Yes, you can override it using a constructor, using a config file, whatever. But the data context is about two things. It's about an entry point to the schema and where things execute. You say, on server 15 in that farm, I want to do this. Well, can't we just be orthogonal there and sort of split things up a little bit more? Couldn't we say that no matter where you write this query, this link to SQL query for a fixed schema, say Northwind, that's the end of it. It's just, you know, the query that expresses what you want to do based on the schema. And then you say that query, oh, by the way, it needs to execute on that scheduler. So now you sort of detangle the schema, the what, from where it executes. And so that's what I'm doing here, is the hypothetical idea of having a remote on operator where you pass in where things need to be executed. Now, what's the beauty of that? That now we're actually dependent, oh my goodness, on an iScheduler. And what's an iScheduler? Well, it's something on which we could have much more operators. We could say that you have two schedulers, one for server 1 that's in Australia, one for server 2 in Europe. And those two SQL schedulers, you know, can be used to actually send a command to. Now, what if SQL scheduler has an OR method? So that you can say, new SQL scheduler in Europe dot OR new SQL scheduler in Australia. Then you've created an iScheduler that will decide based on certain circumstances which server to send it to. You no longer need to have the capability of knowing where to execute your code in the Northwind data context, because that only accepts a single data connection string. Now you can basically have some service that's totally orthogonal to the link to SQL generated code that knows where to execute things on. And so that would be very helpful for things like scheduling stuff in the cloud. So that's why we're called Cloud Programmability Team, to look at those kind of things. So that's actually a random thought. I don't have a demo of that. Now here's another thought. And that's a thought that I will actually show you a little demo of. So expression trees are something, in my opinion, that's quite funny. Let me actually show you what I mean. If you write a link to SQL query, right, from P and products, or like from ticker and stocks, ticker symbol equals Microsoft, ticker.quote, okay? You have that query. What's the life of that query? All the way from where you typed it into Visual Studio to where it starts executing. Here's the little story of the set query, okay? So the query's lifetime starts by the csc.exe compiler looking at it. And the C# compiler says, oh, I see some syntax, I will turn it into an abstract syntax tree. Everything is good, we generate an abstract syntax tree that has method calls in it and so on, like beautiful Christmas tree. Now that tree needs to be assigned to an expression tree somehow. An expression tree is a representation of a tree that's consumable at runtime in system.link.expressions. So we have a tree, we turn it into a different tree. So far, not too bad. That's what compilers do. They transform trees into other ones. So now we have a syntax tree. This is annoying. Now we have a syntax tree at runtime. Now the syntax tree knocks on the door with link to SQL and says, I want to be executed on SQL Server. What does link to SQL do? Link to SQL says, I take the expression tree and turn it into tsql, which is just a little string. Now the little string starts moving on the database and comes into the relational engine, or the query processor. And the query processor says, oh, a little string for me. The little string needs to be turned into a query plan. First, I'm going to turn the string by a parser into a syntax tree. And then the syntax tree becomes an execution tree, and ultimately it executes. So why did we have a tree to begin with? Did we go to a string to send it over the wire, and then reconstruct the tree on the other end? Why couldn't we just take the tree from the left, remote it to the right, and be done with it? So that's basically the question I'm asking here. So this is something we implemented where you can take an rx.net expression tree, serialize it to JSON, and then execute it in reactive extensions for JavaScript on the client. That's sort of the opposite thing, where you go from the server to the client. That makes a lot of sense if you do sensor readings, for example. If you write a query, you know, from geolocations, this and that, you know, on all the clients, well, and you filter on the geolocation, it often makes sense to do the where filter on the device, as opposed to have the device upload every freaking coordinate where it has been. Just upload the ones that you're interested in. So you basically remote parts of the logic closer to the data source. So that's something we actually enabled there, taking a link expression tree and executing it in a totally different execution engine, in this case JavaScript. But we can also take that, you know, into, say, for example, a C++-based database engine that could read that JSON string or XML string out, or representation of a tree. Now, an XML representation of a tree is better than a string representation of a tree because you already have the structure of the tree encoded, right? So that's what we have, remoting of query expressions. So actually, just 1 second, don't use timings anymore going forward. Thank you. So here's the sample. The sample is a little academic, I have to tell you, because this is just my testing code for this feature that, you know, we implemented a while ago. It basically takes expression trees as lambda expressions. So you can basically write a lambda expression and send it to the roundtrip function. And the roundtrip function takes in an action of func of object. So the only thing I'm doing here is I'm taking an expression tree generated by the compiler from a lambda expression, giving it to roundtrip, serialize it to JSON, deserialize it from JSON, and execute it again, and see that the results match with the original one. So I'm just roundtripping this to see whether, you know, it maintains all the information. So all of those should actually print exactly the original thing as if I never serialized and deserialized the whole thing. So let me just, you know, rule out one of them. Well, let's do just one of them first. Actually, I can set a breakpoint here to show you how the serialized expression tree for the constant -132 long actually looks. So that's actually how an expression tree would look for, a serialized expression tree would look for that particular expression. It would be a unary expression that does a subtraction, I think, of a constant expression. No, it's a conversion. There is an implicit conversion in that one. That's why it's actually a test case. But you see there is something, some note in the JSON here that says there is a constant expression with value -133, which is of type int64. So we actually capture all of that info. Now somebody else can take it and execute it. So we can basically serialize those expression trees. They get pretty complicated, as you might imagine. Like if we take an entire link expression, that's what I have sitting here, this guy, an entire link expression using from, let, where, select. If I execute that thing, it's already a little bit bigger, right? The serialized code for that one is a few pages. Actually, the link expression tree generated there is actually also pretty significant because we need to restore some type information of the anonymous types generated. But so we can actually take that and it executes and it gives me exactly the same result as just running it locally. So that's a beautiful thing. We plan on, you know, at some point, no commitments yet, but you might see this technology surface in the future. So that's something we've been working on. The most tricky part is restoring types. So that's actually why we did Rx to RxJS, because in reactive extensions for JavaScript, you can basically filter out all the type info out of the expression tree serialized form, because JavaScript doesn't have types to begin with. Now, if you do the same thing to, for example, the CLR running in SQL Server, well, you might want to ship parts of an assembly, and that gets a little more tricky. So that's actually the reason we're holding off on the technology for a while. But you see the idea exists, and it would be damn useful to actually distribute work, say, for example, in the cloud, where you take an expression tree, send it off to some worker role in Azure, for example. So there we go, remoting of expression trees. So let's actually wrap up with a piece of beauty. So this is like something fascinating in my opinion. So link to the unexpected. I think there was already link to something unexpected, which was linked to nullable types, like, you know, the from, where, to, upper kind of thing. We can do link over a lot of domains. We've seen link to objects, link to SQL. We've seen link to events, link to WMI, which are different kinds of link. Now let's do link to something called Solver Foundation. Now, how many know Solver Foundation or have heard of it? Oh, a few, actually. It's a pretty good outcome here compared to some other audiences, so that's nice. So the idea of Solver Foundation is to optimize problems, I would say, or solutions to problems. So you can basically give it a set of constraints and then ask Solver Foundation to minimize or maximize a certain metric, for example. And that's, you know, the simplified representation of Solver Foundation. So this is how you actually program Solver Foundation today. What I'm doing here is I'm doing a decision problem which just comes out of the help of Solver Foundation to help me decide how much barrels of oil I should get from two countries, Saudi Arabia and Venezuela. And I have a number of constraints here. So first of all, I know the prices of one barrel of oil in every country. I know in Saudi Arabia I pay $20 per barrel. In Venezuela, I pay $15 per barrel. So in other words, I want to minimize the total cost of getting oil, which will be 20 times no matter how much Saudi Arabia I get, and 15 times the number of barrels in Venezuela. Right? And I want to have two decisions. I want to know from Solver Foundation what's the most optimal allocation of barrels of oil in Saudi Arabia and Venezuela. So that's the minimization part. Now, there are some constraints, of course. I need to give it some criteria. And the criteria are that, you know, I need to get to at least, over here, 2,000 barrels of oil that are usable for gasoline. So you see 30% of gasoline in Saudi Arabia. Well, 30% of the oil coming from Saudi Arabia can be used for gasoline. 40% of the oil that comes from Venezuela can be used for gasoline. So that means to Solver Foundation, like, if I need for my production plant 2,000 barrels of gasoline, that if it chooses a number of barrels in Saudi Arabia, only 30% of that number will be applicable for my purpose. But if it chooses more or less from Venezuela, well, there it's 40% of the number it chooses that's applicable for gasoline. So I basically say, no matter what you choose for those two countries, it needs to add up to at least 2,000 barrels usable for gasoline. Here I'm saying the same for jet fuel. 40% in Saudi Arabia is usable as jet fuel, only 20 in Venezuela, but I need a total of 1,500. And finally, for lubricant, I need 500 barrels over here. 20% of all the oil Saudi Arabia is usable for this, 30% in Venezuela. And finally, I say that the maximum number of barrels I can order from those two countries is respectively 9,000 and 6,000, maybe because of the distance or some other, you know, political issues, I can't get more oil. And I also say in C6 and C7 that I shouldn't get less than zero barrels from a country because that would mean shipping oil to a country, and that's not what I'm interested into. So, strictly positive numbers between all those constraints. And Solver Foundation would actually come back to you and say, oh, this is the optimal allocation here for you. If you do this and that, the price will be the lowest. So, that's pretty interesting. However, I don't quite understand the syntax. So, why can't we do this whole thing using link? And the answer is, well, we totally can. So, here we go. Constraints are basically just where clauses. Constraints are filters, right? Where you say, like, if you have a solution, only if those constraints hold, the solution is valid. Otherwise, it's invalid. So you're filtering all the potential solutions based on the ones that met the constraints. To minimize or maximize something, we have something called order by. If you want to maximize something, you order by things ascending, otherwise descending or opposite, you know, depending on how you think about ordering. So we have order by as the way to minimize something in this case. Order the whole things, and you know the one at the top will be the optimal solution. So a couple of things that I should notice here. First of all, this is really linked to the unexpected because it's linked to the intangible. Like, what's the source of this query? The source of this query is something called a model that has two decisions, Venezuela and Saudi Arabia, both of type double. Mathematics tells us that you can't even enumerate the Cartesian product of two doubles, even one double. You can't enumerate the real numbers. You will get in a rabbit hole pretty quickly. Enumerating the real numbers would mean 0.1, 0.0.1, 0.0.0.1, 0.0. Well, I'm not making progress, right? I'm just going down the rabbit hole. So I can't even enumerate that whole domain. I can't just do a table scan, if you will, over all the possible solutions. So what really happens here is that I give algebraic expressions to Solver Foundation, and that thing implements all the high school mathematics books to know how to solve those equations. That's what Solver Foundation does. That means that link doesn't even need to be related to tangible data. It can be, you know, virtual data that sort of comes out of thin air. one more thing is that Solver Foundation only returns, in this case, one value or an exception. An exception if the constraints are not satisfiable. Like, you know, you ask me to do the impossible. Like, if I can only get, like, 5 barrels of oil in this particular country, I can't meet the criteria because I can't get to enough oil for the purposes here. So it might throw an exception. And if it has a solution, it will just give you one solution. It's not like you want to for each over a number of solutions. You ask the minimal solution. There's only one such thing as the minimal solution. So calling solve on this query would actually return a single solution of two doubles as opposed to an innumerable of those guys, right? So that's actually how a query for Solver Foundation would look like. We could go even further. We could blend this together with, say, for example, Rx. Say that you have two observable of decimal that basically monitor the price of barrels of oil in two countries. So the first one is an iObservable of decimal. Oh, the price has gone up, the price has gone down, the price has changed, blah, blah, blah. The second one is exactly the same, but for a different country. Now, say that I have those two reactive queries, and then I insert a little piece of Solver Foundation query, and then I do order by, you know, those prices that dynamically come in from the observable sources. Now I would have a reactive decision system where you can subscribe to that entire query, and whenever the price in either of the countries is changing, the subscribe can send you an email saying, like, today you need to order more there and less over there. So now you basically have sandwiched Solver Foundation logic in between reactive data sources. So that's actually the beauty of using Link for many more domains, that you can start blending them together. So that's actually a sample of Solver Foundation. The thing I want to show you is something pretty much related, which is called Z3. Z3 is a constraint solver by Microsoft Research. It's actually used for verification of software most often. So, for example, C++ pre-fast tools, the tools that, you know, do analysis of code, are based on Z3, where it basically uses, you know, constraints to find out whether a certain block of code is reachable. The entire Hyper-V stack has been verified for security with regards to isolation of virtual machines using Z3, so it's a very powerful tool. I'm going to program Solver Foundation, Z3 here, to solve the constraints of a Sudoku using a Link query. So that's what I promised you at the beginning. So fasten the seatbelts for Solver Foundation. No, Z3, excuse me. So here we go. So here I have a query over Z3. I'm basically defining a constraint problem. That's not the Sudoku one yet, just to show you the ID. Given three symbols, x1, x2, and x3, I want to get a solution. Like, imagine you're back in, you know, high school, and, you know, the teacher asks you to solve, like, a matrix of 15 times 15, you know, on the exam, and you have 1 hour to do so. And, oh, my goodness, let's diagonalize this and do this and that. Oh, my goodness. Actually, if you would have Solver Foundation with you in your little suitcase, you could just give it this query. You could say, and the teacher asks me, you know, a solution where x1 minus x2 is larger or equal to 1. It's already inequalities. That's even harder to do, you know, with pen and paper. X1 minus x2 needs to be also lower or equal to 3. So it can be 1, 2, and 3. And x1 needs to be twice x3 plus 1 times x2. So you basically give all those constraints. And now you ask Z3, do you know solutions for x1, x2, and x3 that meet the criteria? So if I press F5, it basically, that's fine, it talks to Z3 over here by giving it some Lisp kind of syntax-y piece of code. That's what you see over here. So it's prefix notation. It says, you know, x1 minus x2 needs to be larger or equal to 1. So it basically translates the Link query into something that, you know, Z3 understands. That's something I don't like to write. I just want to write C-sharp code. So we sent all of those constraints to Z3, and Z3 comes back and says, yes, if x1 is 0, x2 is minus 2, and x3 is 3, all the constraints hold. So that's what Z3 is very good and efficient at actually solving. So the other sample I have here is this one. That's the Sudoku. Whoops, I didn't want to see this. Actually, I don't want to see it at all. Okay, like this. So this is basically a Sudoku where I communicate to Z3 all the cells I know. So I basically looked in the little book on the airplane, and it says on row 1, column 3, there is a 2. On 7 and 9, there is a 7, and so on and so on. You give all those constraints to Z3. In fact, the Sudoku class also gives some additional constraints, meaning that every cell needs to be between 1 and 9, they need to be distinct, unique, all of that stuff. We execute that piece of code and we'll end up with a huge question. Ask to Z3, there we are, here's the solution of the Sudoku, just print it in rectangular form. And if you look, you know, the way that actually executes in Z3 is by sending it all of this code, which is generated from my link query expression. Because I know what the Sudoku is, I know all the constraints, right? Quite a few constraints to Sudokus, as you can see. More than you actually think by just looking at the little book. So that basically says that every cell needs to be between 1 and 9, they need to be distinct, whatever. So that's what I do here, and out it comes. And then I said, you know, let's look at all sorts of airplane magazines and, you know, things that you find in little bookstores, like Kenken puzzles. You can also do, you can do Kakuro puzzles using this. You can do all sorts of puzzles, like lots of fun on the airplane. Instead of solving it, write the link provider. So, yeah, you know. And it's more impressive for the people sitting next to you. What are you doing? I'm solving a Sudoku. Oh. Didn't get any dates with that, unfortunately. Can try. So, anyway, futuristic perspective. We started with this slide, we end with this slide. Next 5 years will depend on what we can do in our team, but it has to do with cloudy stuff. We've already invented reactive extensions. We've also taken some of the reactive extensions operators and put them back in a link to objects kind of library called interactive extensions, which just ships with reactive extensions as separate DLL. So we've actually added some expressiveness to the standard query operators. It's much more stuff that might come on the back end, meaning more link providers that become available out of the box where you can talk to. We already have link to SharePoint that shipped with SharePoint 2010. That's a recent addition to that spectrum. And then you will likely see from our team some additional stuff, like, you know, the remoting facility might ship at some point. If you want to build those state machines of types for, you know, strong verification of query expressions at compile time, I don't expect you to write those state machines and all those operator overloads yourself. That could be something that totally can be done in a toolkit that generates all that code based on some specification. We've invested in schedulers, and so schedulers might become important towards cloud kind of programming scenarios. So a lot of stuff out there, a lot of random thoughts. I hope at least one or two gave you some inspiration to try and do something and, you know, write link providers for Sudokus maybe. With that, I think I'm at the end, and I want to thank you once more for your incredible attention. Thank you.